This is Phil Ferrand, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. I don't think I'm coming in tomorrow. At least I hope not, because I have a lot of writing to do. More on that in a moment. It's been a good week at work. Everything's puttering along. We are hopefully getting ready for our first big test in June, and I think pretty much everything's in place for that. We just have some final little testing that I don't want to do until we get our from email address, but we're waiting on that. I'm going to start pushing next week to get that. I'm going to start pushing hard. In case you're wondering, why is Phil going over speed bumps? Phil is going over speed bumps because I'm actually at the rehabilitation facility at Maranatha, where my mom was. I just dropped in for a visit. She was sleeping, so I stared at her for a while. And then talked to the nurse about a few little issues here and there. And now I'm heading home. So anyways, my mom now has been in rehab for coming up on 2 weeks. This Sunday she'll be 2 weeks worth. And, I couldn't really say exactly how things are going, but she's there and they're working with her and they're, you know, trying to get her stronger. And I'm sure they're doing their best, if for nothing else, then if she doesn't make progress, they are going to get paid. So, but they all do seem like very sweet people, and they do seem like they're making their best effort. So that's good. But it's very interesting when your patient has dementia and she can only remember back about 30 seconds to a minute. And she won't eat. She just, doesn't want to eat. So that's, that doesn't work out so well. But, we're moving forward day at a time, step at a time. Ta-da. As you can imagine, with my mom being in rehabilitation, having broken her hip, a lot of the relatives are calling and wanting to know how things are going. So those lead to big conversations. There's swinging by before I go home, and there's this, that, and the other. And so, my normal writing schedule has pretty much gotten turned upside down. But, despite all of that, I'm within about 8,000 words of being at 80,000 words for the first writing sprint. First writing sprint is approximately 8 weeks, 80,000 words, 10,000 words a week. That is the target, because these books are landing somewhere less than 150,000 words normally. So theoretically, 80,000 words is over halfway. So I go back working on the beta corrections for book 6. I start that June 1st, which means that I have almost a week left of writing. And Monday is a holiday. So that means I have 4 solid days here to get 8,000 words put down. And that is very, very doable, because I have hit 4,000 words in a day before. 3,500 is a pretty good load, but I have done that in a day fairly consistently. So if I can get... if I can get good, solid block of writing time in, should be able to do that. I should be able to put down 2,000 words tomorrow. That puts me within 6,000 words. I should theoretically be able to put down 3,000 words on Saturday and Sunday. That would put me, at the 8,000 right there. So I do have a little extra time. We'll just see where this goes. And if not, we've got a little extra on the backside and we'll make this work. So anyways, I still am not exactly sure how this book ends. I just am floating the possibilities in my brain and letting things just mull. And I may not know when I break to go back and do the beta corrections for book six. Sometimes I gotta go back and do the break, work through the beta corrections for book six or for whatever book I'm working on. That triggers something, and I'm like, oh yeah, I could tie that in. This really is a marvelous way to write. I like this a lot. Because the beta version comes back in before I'm done with the next book, which means that I can put stuff in the whatever beta book it is before it goes to production. I can put stuff in there that foreshadows what's going to happen in the next book. You know, so that when people are writing, they're like, how did you know that was coming up? Well, because I was in the middle of writing that book when I was doing the beta corrections for the production. So it works out really well. I really like this. But all in all, things are puttering along. You know, that all seems to be going fine. This book that I'm currently working on, book seven, may just end up in being unusual. It may just be mostly core dump of all the things actually I'm going to talk about today. I have been visiting with friends. It's been a little over a month now because I came across some information that is more of that information where I think to myself, I am 58 years old. Why did no one tell me this sooner? And before I get started on any of this, I should say right off the bat that this podcast is going to be very earthy and plain, and it's going to be talking about female and male construction, and it's going to be something that is not necessarily for the squeamish. So if you are easily offended by matters of physicality, I would very much suggest that you turn the podcast off now. Because if you don't turn the podcast off now, I'm going to assume that you are ready to hear what I have to say. And you are not going to be offended by words that describe genitalia. I heartily recommend that you do not listen to this with children, because this is not a children's podcast. This is going to be an adult podcast. I tell people that this book series I'm working on now is for adults. It is not, the Windfall series is not adult novels. You know, it's not erotica or anything like that. But it is quite plain and it is quite earthy. And in fact, the information that I'm about to talk about is in book seven. I just found myself in a situation where all of a sudden I was doing a core dump on this information. And I could certainly have left it there. I could certainly have not spent a podcast talking about this. But you know, I'm 58 years old, and no one ever told me this. And it explains so many things that I cannot, in good conscience, not do a podcast on this. I know I've talked a lot about male and female stuff, but there's pieces of information in here that I think are really important. You don't have to agree with me. You don't have to listen to this podcast. You can shut this off. But honestly, if we leave the television and movie and advertising industries, the entertainment industrial complex, if we leave it to them to give us the foundation of our beliefs in how male-female relationships are supposed to work, it will all be upside down and twisted and guaranteed to create an environment of failure for us. On the other hand, if we are honest and open and we have very very open and frank discussions about some of these things, and we are willing to believe that some of these things might be true, we might find ourselves in a position where we will understand a bit better our significant others. And for me, that's a plus. Period. It's a plus. So, I've given you plenty of opportunity to shut this podcast off. And if you are still here, I'm going to assume that you would at least to hear the ideas, and I will assume that you are mature enough to listen and to decide if this is something that either makes sense or does not make sense to you, and you are free to do with it whatever you will, but at least I have made an effort to present the information. The information actually comes from two different podcasts, and I will tell you off the bat that neither of these podcasts reach the conclusions in whole that I reached when listening to them. They have pieces of information, but they don't necessarily have the whole. So if you run off and listen to these podcasts, you will hear things that I haven't mentioned that you may decide are more important than what I did mention. And you will hear things that maybe you didn't want to hear because they both have very frank discussions about sexuality as well. So, be forewarned, I thought they were excellent podcasts. I thought they had a lot of really interesting information. And then from that, I have derived what I am going to say. And I don't think I have done injustice to anything that they presented. So the two podcasts, they're both TED Talks. They're both on YouTube. The first one is called Fertile, Flirty, and Fierce by Christina Durante. And the second one is called The Pleasure Principle, The Secret to a Better Sex Life by Lori Betito. All right, so in the first one, the lecturer comes on stage and she says, I want to begin by asking you to imagine what the next 28 days of your life, and for each of the 28 days, I want you to predict how often you will think about sex. Of course, there's scattered giggles through the crowd. She throws up a graph, and on this graph, you've got the vertical bar of how many times do you think about sex, and the horizontal bar is these 28 days in a row, or a month. She says, here's what we might see for most men. Unsurprisingly, the graph for men is basically all the way up at the top, and it's just mainly a solid line. And it just goes right across the top of the graph because most men, on average, in general, think about sex all the time. At least we say that's what they're thinking about now. The big surprise comes in the next graph. She said, and here's what we might see for women. It's a different pattern. And it might surprise you that there does come a time when women think about sex just as much as men do, because the graph for women starts off fairly low. It's in the lower third, and then it climbs, and then it peaks, and then it comes back down, and it does this once. And it does it once every 28 days. Now, if you know anything about female physiology, it's probably not hard for you to guess when that peaks. One moment, I need to turn into my driveway here. She says, let's see. Women begin to think about sex just as much as men do, rather than being the next. This graph represents the woman's ovulatory cycle, which spans an average of 28 days. And this pink line that's tracking women's sexual thoughts actually maps onto the fluctuations in the ovarian hormone estrogen across the cycle. Estrogen peaks right before women ovulate, and that happens about 14 days into the 28-day cycle. This is when women release a single sex cell known as an ovum or an egg, and this is the only time for women that sex can result in a pregnancy. So it's no surprise that sex, that women think about sex a little bit more leading up to this point in time. Now then, she also goes on to say, men are constantly producing millions of sperm cells, and they always carry with them the possibility that sex can result in reproduction. Therefore, they maintain that fairly high and stable level of sexual thoughts. I'm getting my mail. Because women... And stable level, because women can only reproduce when they ovulate. Now, when I saw this graph, I looked at it and I thought to myself, well, of course. Of course. Because we have a tendency to obscure what is really happening in life. We have a tendency, both because of our flesh and because of the world, because the world wants to obscure this as well, because by obscuring this, it creates an environment of failure. We assign names and labels to things that would be better suited to other names. So just for a moment here, I'm backing into my garage. Just for a moment here, why don't we assign sex drive, the term sex drive, why don't we assign it a name that is more apropos? And that name simply is reproductive drive, or the drive to reproduce. Why do men think about the act of reproduction so frequently? They think about the act of reproduction because they can participate in the ritual of reproduction every single day. Sometimes multiple times during the day. That's a whole other story. Why would women think about the drive, think about the act of reproduction less? Why would women be driven less to participate in the ritual of reproduction? Because they can only conceive once a month. This is very simple. And once a woman conceives, she's out. At a base primitive level, she's out for 9 months and several weeks after she gives birth. If this basic drive is what we're really talking about when we talk about sex drive, it is absolute foolishness to classify women who are not thinking about sex all the time as having, what is it, hyposexual drive. Well, there's something wrong with them because, you know, they don't want to have sex all the time. You know, because in order to do that, what you have to say is, well, the standard is men. They're the gold standard. And so anything that's less than that, well, there must be something wrong with them. There's nothing wrong with them. They just have a completely different reproductive system. So whereas men are driven all the time by this system, sometimes more, sometimes less, women are not driven by this system at all. Now, there's some really just some interesting things out of this, and I'll go through them briefly. So how does this woman prove, what evidence does she have that this is actually going on, that this is what we're talking about? Well, she said one of the interesting experiments they did, Aside from just asking women, is she said we bring in women and we give them a piece of paper that has some kind of cutout dolls on it. And she said we give them a canister of paper, pencils, and we say, imagine that you're going to a party at a friend's house tonight. From what these friends tell you, there's going to be a lot of attractive and single people. And you need to start thinking about what you are going to wear. And when you have an idea, go ahead and draw it on the paper doll. What are you going to wear to the party? So they did this multiple times during the month. And what they found consistently is that when a woman is not ovulating and her estrogen levels are relatively low, she draws an outfit that is fairly conservative. It's fashionable, but it's fairly conservative, you know, long maxi skirt, you know, maybe in just one shoulder off, but long sleeve, blah, 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 blah. When she's ovulating, the hem of the skirt comes up, the top of the top goes down. It's much more what we would consider dressing sexy. And she said, this is a shift we see across women within the range of what the woman would normally wear. And she said, you might be thinking this ovulating outfit here and say, well, that's an outfit that's meant to directly impress a man. She said, but remember that this is only effective if women have not first ensured that they're as attractive or as sexy as all the other women, what the other women were wearing. So they did this thing where they actually kind of hinted to the woman who was drawing the picture, kind of who else would be there and kind of what they were wearing. And so not only did they see this pattern just when they had the woman imagined by herself, but they could manipulate how suggestive the outfits would be just by suggesting that other women might be there in more suggestive outfits. In other words, women, for the most part, are not dressing to impress men. They're dressing to compete with other women, because good men are a scarce resource, or at least what they consider to be a good man. She goes into this whole thing about Mr. Right and the loving the bad boys and stuff, and that's all very interesting, but it doesn't really have to do with what I want to talk about. So you can watch the TED Talk and see what it says there. And I can't remember if she said it or somebody else said it in terms of women obsess over things on their outfit that no guy cares about. We don't care if your shoes match your handbag. We don't care if you're wearing silver and gold jewelry together. We don't care. But yet women obsess about that. Why? Because they want to make themselves feel more powerful and they want to send a signal to the other women who are potential competitors that they are more stylish, they are more deserving, everybody should get out of my way. Now, there's one last piece of this that I thought was very, very interesting. She said, and oh, yeah, by the way, and she just kind of threw this in at one point. But this is also very important as far as I'm concerned. She said, oh, yeah, by the way, women on hormonal birth control do not, ovulate. It's got oblivate on here. The closed captioning was spelled wrong, and I couldn't remember the word ovulate. Women who are on birth control do not ovulate, and therefore the effects that I've allowed today would be absent in these women. Okay, that's really important. Because as I understand it, hormonal birth control convinces a woman's body that she's pregnant. So, it is the most natural thing in the world for whatever drive for reproduction, whatever reproductive drive there might be in a woman, that when she is on the pill, she probably is not that interested in participating in the ritual of reproduction. Now, you could say, well, no, wait, look, college girls are all out there, blah, blah, blah. You know, you could come up with all sorts of objectives. Okay, it is true that the drive for reproduction is not only hormonal. I would submit that it's much more hormonal in men than it is in women. And as proof of that, I would offer to you that every guy out there will tell you that there is a dramatic shift in his attitudes and what he's thinking about it pre-ritual of reproduction to post-ritual of reproduction, at least his participation in it. Because when the event happens, the attitudes and everything inside a guy's mind instantly change. I mean, it's like day and night. You know, one moment, you're panting and you're focused and you're like, ah, you know, and then kaboom. And all of a sudden, it's like, I think I'm going to go out in the kitchen and get something to eat. And if you're a good husband, you know better than not to roll off and go get something to eat. You know better that you should just hang around for a while. Because that type of thing bewilders women. Because women are not built that way. So I would suggest to you that hormonally, men are much more driven when it comes to the desire to participate in the ritual of reproduction. With women, though, there's more to it. Because not only is a woman looking just to participate in the ritual of reproduction, she also knows and she fears the fact that if she does become pregnant, she knows she is going to become increasingly incapacitated through this whole process. It's a huge investment for a woman. And so I think women are not only driven by that hormonal process, but they're also driven by the entire sphere of needs that surround the ritual and the process of reproduction. Therefore, if she's looking for someone to mate with, someone that's going to protect her, someone that's going to guard the gates from the Visigoths and the barbarians, someone that is going to provide for her when she's raising her children, someone that is going to be the ox that will go out and bring in the food and blah, 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 blah. Her motivations, while they will fluctuate with hormones, can also be driven by these fears of not finding someone. I was talking to one friend about this in the last month, and he said, well, but, you know, when I was in college, I ended up doing some things I shouldn't have done. And he said, there was this one gal that, you know, she just loved sex. And I'm going to get to the second part of that in just a minute. But the first part of that is, well, yeah, she was single. And she was looking for someone. And so she's driven a little harder than a married woman would be. And then there is the second part, which we're going to come to in a minute. So the conclusion of this first talk was really that women need to understand that they are going to fluctuate in their thinking about the ritual of reproduction over the 28 days. Unless they're on hormonal birth control, and then it could be very likely that they wouldn't think about it at all. Unless they're single, and then what they'll be thinking about is, I really would like to be married. And if I have to put up with that, then okay. My dad was telling me that he dated a young woman that he almost got married with, but she just told him flat out, if we get married, there is not going to be any sex. I don't like it. We're not doing it. That's it. Well, at least she was honest. And that was at that point that he said, okay, thank you, goodbye. And maybe that's why we don't talk about these things more, because if guys went into these situations completely open-minded and clear-sighted, maybe they would think twice. Anyway, second talk. Which is the pleasure principle, blah, blah, blah. She has some good things to say in it, but specifically, she started talking about the construct of the male genitalia versus the female genitalia. And what I took away from that was this interesting idea that with the man, the ritual of reproduction is tightly coupled with pleasure. It's all the same thing. In fact, it feels so much all the same thing that guys in their minds would not normally separate those two. I mean, guys will just tell you, well, but it feels so good to have intercourse. Well, but it feels so good to ejaculate. Because there is no thought about the fact that it's really their hormones to reproduce that are driving them, and then in addition to that, they always get this additional pop of pleasure. Guys don't even think about that. The female construction is markedly different. In fact, they are two different subsystems. And the second woman started talking about the fact that a woman has the reproductive machinery, and nearby, but not merged, is her pleasure machinery. So, you've got the clitoris, which is the pleasure machinery, and you've got the vagina, which is the reproductive machinery. And while there is some sensation there, the fact of the matter is that in order for most women to have the ultimate pleasure experience, i.e., an orgasm, there needs to be direct clitoral stimulation. I told you this was going to be plain. In fact, this woman said 75% of women cannot orgasm through intercourse alone, and it doesn't matter if he's thrusting for 10 minutes or 10 hours, it's not going to work. We need clitoral stimulation to get us there. It's really important. And she said, interestingly, the latest research that shows the women who have orgasms through intercourse, it shows that the distance between the vaginal opening and the clitoris is shorter, so they are getting pressure on the clitoris. But that's the exception. And in addition to that, I started thinking about this marrying of the reproductive process and pleasure and how it's so tightly coupled in men. But from this, we can see that it is not coupled in the majority of women. That is really important because it is then women's experience that the pleasure is off over there somewhere. And what you have is the reproductive drive. And I think the other thing that's extremely important to note in all of this, and when I've told my buddies about this, they kind of look at me a minute, and then they think, and then they nod their heads. Because men never think twice about the reproductive processes that are going on in their bodies. Their little engines are just down there working away. And the only reason that we have any hint of that happening is because the testosterone level builds up in our brains. And then it's like, I gotta do something about this. But there's no burning, there's no sensation, there's nothing. We just get this, I need to do something about it. And it sure is going to feel good when I do. When you go over and say, what's the corresponding experience for women? It's completely different. Yes, a woman can have as many orgasms as she wants. Anytime she wants. Yes. But what does her reproductive cycle look like? Well, you got PMS, you know, you got breast hurting, you got cramps, you got headaches, you got moodiness, you got this, that, and the other. And then the actual process of menstruation, you've got blood, you've got more cramps, you've got more hurting, et cetera, et cetera. And it can occupy like 2 weeks out of the whole reproductive cycle. This is not something that makes you think, yay, I can reproduce. What also I find interesting about this is that men think they're driven just because of the pleasure. But what if they're not driven because of the pleasure? What if they are driven nearly exclusively because of the reproductive drive to participate in the ritual? I think if that's true, then it makes perfect sense what's actually happening, because the fact is, even though women could sit in a closet or a room and have multiple orgasms all day, they don't. Vast majority of them do not. Do not. They don't. And I've heard some women say, well, that's because I was shamed when I was young, you know, because I was really young and I put my hand down my pants and my mom said, don't do that. You shouldn't touch yourself. And I never did it again. Oh, okay. So I don't think the problem is someone told you don't touch yourself, because people have been telling little boys not to touch themselves since the world began. And the little boy just goes, oh, okay. And then walks around the back of the house and starts back up again. Because there's more drive going on there, you know, because you get back to that foundation of lust versus fear. And so when you factor all these things together, for me, what happens is it becomes patently absurd to have one standard by which we judge whether or not someone has a normal, quote-unquote, sex drive, or a low sex drive, or a high sex drive. It is patently absurd to have one standard that is being applied to both men and women. And it's simply another example of the fact that for generations, every time, ever since we started categorizing stuff, that we would start with the male perspective and then decrease it by 70% because women are just like men. Decrease it by 80%. I've talked before about the fact that for the longest time, when we were trying to figure out what dosages should be of medicines and things. The tests were done on men. And then the standard was, well, okay, so a woman's body weight is usually about 70 or 80% of men, so we'll just decrease the dosage by 80%. It is just absurd to say, well, the male standard for desire for reproduction is all the time. Therefore, the female standard for reproduction, for a drive to reproduction, should be most of the time. No, no, it shouldn't. It should not, period. It should be what the average female standard is. And it makes perfect sense that for a woman who is not on birth control, who is married, it makes perfect sense that her drive would accelerate once a month. It makes perfect sense that a woman who is on birth control but does not have children yet, that her drive would be suppressed by the pills convincing her body that she's pregnant. It makes perfect sense that once she has had two or three children, since it is the drive for reproduction, not a sex drive, it makes perfect sense that she would, at that point, having had as many children as she wants to have, find within her that the drive for reproduction would slack off. Now, I can hear the guys out there saying, but, intercourse is not just about reproduction. Intercourse is about intimacy. Intercourse is about this. Intercourse is about that. And all of that is absolutely true. But bear in mind, our perspective is skewed because the drive for reproduction is tangled up in pleasure, and it's hard for us to separate it. And bear in mind, it is not tangled up in a woman's physiology. And the fact is that most women, even though they could have multiple orgasms per day just by using a vibrator, do not. They do not. What does that tell us? If in men, pleasure and reproduction was decoupled, we would not be nearly so interested in driving forward, trying to stimulate ourselves when there was no way to reproduce. I will guarantee you that's the truth. And when you factor in fear versus lust, fear as the common foundation for a woman's life, when you factor fear in, sometimes that results in a higher drive to pretend to be like a man, to pretend to do what a man wants, to pretend to woo a man, to pretend to be flirty and fierce and all those things, because there's really a desire to find someone who will be the guard at the gates more than there is to actually participate in the ritual of reproduction. But if it just comes down to the pleasure of it, there's a ton of different ways to get pleasure. There's food, there's entertainment, there's pets, there's raising kids, you know, children. Children can be delightful. They can also not be delightful. There's grandkids. There's doing something that you enjoy doing, and you don't have to get naked, and you don't have to worry about are you going to perform well enough, and you don't have to worry about what's going to happen afterwards. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff. So in the pantheon of things that bring you pleasure and relieve the anxiety of level in your life, pleasure, just sexual pleasure, is not at the top. And that makes complete sense as well. So, there you go. Things to think about. I'm not asking you to agree with me. And I'm not going to apologize if I offended you, because I gave you plenty of chance to back out of this. But I just think that if we don't at least teach men this, that we are going to keep having happen what is happening now. And that is, we let the industrial entertainment advertising complex set up an environment of failure for us because women, as they are written in the industrial entertainment advertising complex, are far more interested in the ritual of reproduction and far more flirty than women are in real life. And that does two things. It creates an unfulfilled desire and confusion in men over what am I doing wrong? Why is this woman not behaving like what I see on TV? And it creates an environment of confusion for women. What's wrong with me? Why am I so inadequate? Why don't I feel like the same way as I see people on TV? And all of that inadequacy and confusion makes people primed to buy products. And it also sets up an environment of failure where men end up on porn sites, where men end up having affairs because they do not understand what's happening, when what should be happening is men should understand more how their wives function, and they should be having open conversations about that, and they should be crafting the relationship that they can craft with their wife instead of having these unrealistic expectations. And at the end of the day, it is the man's problem to take care of the fact that he may have his little engines working away, wanting to participate in the ritual of reproduction, when his wife may not be as interested in that as he is. So it's up to him, in my opinion, to take responsibility for that and be done. There you go. Think about it. And throw it all out if you want. I'm sure this podcast has gone for like 45, 50 minutes, if not an hour at this point. I apologize, but I needed to say it. I done said it. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.